We always opened our meals by invoking the memory of Sant Cartas. The gist of it was that our minds might be nourished by all manner of ideas originating from thinkers dating all the way back to Canoas. But for the physical nourishment of our bodies, we relied upon one another, joined in the discipline that we owed to Cartas. Diolaters, on the other hand, all had different pre-meal rituals. Bayesian Orthodoxy was a post-agrarian religion in which literal sacrifice had been replaced by symbolic. They opened their meals with a reenactment and effigy of that, then praised their god for a while, then asked him for goods and services. The priest who ran the retreat center launched into it out of habit, but got unnerved in the middle when he noticed that none of the avowed were bowing their heads, just gazing at him curiously. I didn't think he was all that troubled by our not believing what he believed. He must have been used to that. He was more embarrassed that he'd committed a faux pas. So when he was finished, he implored us to say whatever sort of blessing or invocation might be traditional in the math. As mentioned, we were strangely lacking in sopranos and altos, but we were able to put together enough tenors, baritones, and basses to sing a very ancient and simple invocation of Cartas. Fra Jad handled the drone, and I could swear he made the silverware buzz on the tables. The four monks seemed to enjoy this very much, and when we'd finished, they stood up and did an equally ancient-sounding prayer. It must have dated back to the early centuries of their monastic age, just after the fall of Baz, because their old orth was indistinguishable from ours, and it had obviously been composed in a time before the music of the maths and of the monasteries had diverged. If you didn't listen too carefully to the words, you could easily mistake this piece for one of ours. The conversation during the meal had to be superficial compared to the events of the last 24 hours, given that we had to talk in Flukish and couldn't mention the ship in earshot of our hosts. I became frustrated, then bored, then drowsy, and ate mostly in silence. Cord and Rosk talked to each other. They weren't religious, and I could tell they felt awkward here. One of the young women on the staff made lavish efforts to make them feel welcome, which mostly backfired. Saman was absorbed in his jija, which he had somehow patched into the retreat center's communication system. Barb had found a list of the camp rules and was memorizing it. Our 300ers sat in a cluster and talked amongst themselves. They could not speak Flukish and didn't have the thousander glamour that had made Fra Jad the center of attention with the Bayesian monks. I noticed that Arcibald was deep in conversation with Furman, and that Cord and Rosk had shifted closer to them. So I wandered over to see what they were talking about. It seemed that Furman had been thinking about the Skonix and wanted to know more. Arcibald, for lack of any other way to pass the time, had launched into a kalka called The Fly, the Bat, and the Worm, which was a traditional way of explaining the Skonix theory of time and space to Fids.
"Look at that fly crawling around on the table," Arcibald said. "No, don't shoo it away. Just look at it. The size of its eyes."
Furman Beller gave it a quick glance and then returned his eyes to his dinner.
"Yeah, half of its body seems to be eyes.
Thousands of separate eyes, actually. It doesn't seem as though it could possibly work."
Arcibald reached back behind himself and waved his hand around, nearly hitting me in the face.
"Yet if I wave my hand back here, far away, it doesn't care. Knows there is no threat. But if I bring my hand closer..."
Arcibald brought his hand forward. The fly took off.
"Somehow its microscopic brain takes signals from thousands of separate primitive eyes and integrates them into a correct picture, not merely of space, but of space-time. It knows where my hand is. Knows that if my hand keeps moving thus, it'll soon squash it. So it had better change its position."
"You think the cousins have eyes like that?"
Beller asked. Arcibald dodged sideways.
"Maybe they're like bats instead. A bat would have detected my hand by listening for echoes."
Beller shrugged.
"All right. Maybe the cousins squeak like bats.
On the other hand, when I shift my body to swat the fly, it creates a pattern of vibrations in the table that a creature, even a deaf and blind one, such as a worm, might feel."
"Where is this going?"
Beller asked.
"Let's do a thought experiment," Arcibald said. "Consider a proton fly. By that, I mean the pure, ideal form of a fly.
Meaning what?
All eyes. No other sense organs.
All right. I'm considering it,
Beller said, trying to be good-humored. Now, a proton bat.
All ears?
Yes. Now a proton worm.
Meaning all touch?
Yes. No eyes, ears, or nose, just skin.
Are we going to do all five senses?
It would start to become boring, so let's stop with three, Archibald said. We place the fly, the bat, and the worm in a room with some object, let's say a candle. The fly sees its light. The bat squeals at it and hears its echoes. The worm feels its warmth and can crawl over it to feel its shape.
It sounds like the old parable of the six blind men and the—
No, said Archibald. This is completely different. Almost the opposite. The six blind men all have the same sensory equipment. Beller nodded, seeing his mistake.
Yeah, but the fly, the bat, and the worm have different ones.
And the six blind men disagree about what it is they are groping.
But the fly, the bat, and the worm agree?
Beller asked, raising an eyebrow. You sound skeptical. Rightly so. But they are all sensing the same object, are they not?
Well, sure,
Beller said.
But when you say that they agree with each other, I don't know what that means.
It's a fascinating question, so let's explore it. Let's change the rules a little, said Archibald, just to set the stakes a little higher and make it so that they have to agree. The thing in the middle of the room isn't a candle. Now it's a trap.
A trap?
Beller laughed.